Good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? People making a difference in our collective thought process, in our progress as a species all around our planet these days. And you know, a lot of you are really excited about who I'm talking to today or tonight. It's J. Kim Wright, who's a lawyer, and she's making a difference through a website, a virtual office called Cutting Edge Law. And Kim's taking law, and I guess you've had others that have been helping you prompt this wave, but in any case, you're taking law into a much more holistic, I guess, reality, where lawyers will learn to look after themselves and their hearts and souls and their integrity, along with helping that community. Is that how you'd say it, Kim? And welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks. I might say it that way. What I often do is I offer it as an inquiry. Mm-hmm. What if lawyers were peacemakers, problem solvers, and healers of conflicts? And I do that because an inquiry actually has us start to think about something rather than reacting to it.
Oh, I see. Yes, it sort of creates a reactiveness. It's funny, the reason I'm having you on is because I'm very fascinated, of course, in people making a difference. But I met some women lawyers when I was at a retreat in Denver. And several of them were talking about being in the law and being women. And I said, well, women I knew years ago that became lawyers got frustrated and pulled out and got into various types of community work. And that's when they said, well, we have somebody for you to talk to. And so let's talk about you as a lawyer. What made you take your practice of the law into something different, to morph it or...
Well, I actually went to law school because I had seven kids at home, and we had various legal issues with the kids, and I decided that I was going to become a lawyer because it was easier and cheaper, and I would have more power as a lawyer than just their mom in the court system or their stepmom in several cases. And
well, you took on a lot of children, didn't you?
I did. That's actually kind of a long story, but I had a total of 16 children live with me between 1977 and 2003.
Well, were you a social worker or just very fecund, as they say?
I tell people that I'm a social worker with a law degree. I was not actually a social worker, but I took very seriously that it takes a village to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I married a man with five children after I already had one, and we had one together, so we had seven. I'm fond of saying that some children bring home stray puppies, and mine brought home stray children. And in particular, my youngest daughter, I call her the cosmic social worker, and she would go to Chapel Hill, which is where we live, and she would meet kids, and she would screen them. And she would say, this one really is special. And we would take them in. And so she became friends with them, or we became a support for them. And so, as I said, a total of 16 kids lived with us. But we were kind of a haven for a lot of kids, whether they lived with us or not. Mm-hmm. At one time we had 12 homeless teenagers for Christmas dinner.
Oh, my gosh. And so were they street kids or...?
There were street kids. There were kids whose parents didn't understand them. A lot of them were kids that some people would call indigo children or oppositional children, at-risk kids. I mean, there were a lot of labels that were put on them, but they were kids who were really special, and they were paradigm shifters themselves.
Hmm.
They didn't fit into sort of that traditional model, and they found a home with us because neither did we.
Hmm.
And
Hard work? I mean, did you have battles with them or legal? Like you said, you went into law because of the legal hassles sometimes.
The battles were with my stepchildren and their other parents who didn't necessarily agree with the way we wanted the children to be raised, or that the children wanted to live with us, or, you know, there were various things, and I had a husband at the time who was into civil disobedience, we just kind of kept bumping against the legal system during that time. But some of the other kids did have run-ins with the law, and I learned about restorative justice, for example.
And what is restorative justice?
In restorative justice, the focus is on healing the harm of the crime.
Oh.
And so in the particular case that I'm thinking of, so my daughter, the cosmic social worker, was in a car accident, and it turned out that the young man who was driving was under the influence. Hmm. And several of the kids were just enraged because my daughter was just, you know, the chosen one in the community, and they went and vandalized the house of the family of the boy who was under the influence and caused the accident. And so, thank goodness, the parents were very understanding, and they actually offered that we all sit down together.
Oh, wow, brilliant.
And they listened to the story. They listened to the apologies of the kids who had actually, you know, lost their tempers and had done the damage. And they also listened to their underlying motivation and the issues having to do with their son. And so it actually became this marvelous resolution, which my kids, the kids that were involved in advocating for my daughter, which is how it occurred for them, ended up cleaning up the mess.
Oh, wow,
and,
that's great.
And had a really good experience with the parents, who were just amazing people. And that was really my first time of seeing restorative justice in action, which is one of the types of law that I see as part of this movement toward a more healing paradigm of law.
Well, just tell me this first before we go through this list. You have a wonderful list of types of law, but were the parents of the child that was under the influence, were they actually legal people, or were they just conscious parents, or what?
They actually were lawyers.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And they were personal injury lawyers, both of them.
Aha.
And just great folks. I mean, you know, they were conscious parents, but they really saw that they didn't want my kids to go to jail. It would just be adding on to an already bad situation.
But they must have had an innate consciousness of restorative justice, hey?
They did.
Mm. All right, well, carry on with these different types. That's a really interesting story. You don't hear many like that, but I bet you have a number, huh?
I do.
Well, give them to us. We love it.
Well, and I was a divorce lawyer.
Oh, you were?
And so I came from the background of having had 3 divorces of my own when I was practicing law.
You were doing internships,
and
were you?
I was learning. And I was concerned about the kids. So, for example, when I divorced the father of the 5 children, I ended up with some of the kids. We didn't divide them along the lines that the law might have otherwise divided them. And I'm still in their family today. I've been divorced from him since 1987.
Hmm.
But I have grandchildren that aren't even clear that I'm not a biological relative. And so
that's really great in this day and age when so many homes are kind of broken up and rearranged, eh?
Yeah, I once wrote an article about a new paradigm of family that my friend said that you needed a 3D diagram to understand all the different relationships in my family.
So
as a divorce lawyer, I was really concerned about the well-being of kids.
Mm-hmm.
And going to court is not good for kids, or anybody else for that matter, but particularly not good for kids. So I looked into other approaches, and I discovered collaborative law and mediation.
Mm-hmm.
So in collaborative law, the lawyers and the husband and the wife actually sign a contract saying, we're not going to court. We're going to work this out in a non-adversarial, paradigm-shifted kind of way that's focused on the greatest good for the whole family.
Hmm.
And,
that must be pretty tricky when people are already steaming and pounding their feet on the floor, you know.
Well, you can fan that flame, or you can help people actually work through their emotions. And one of the things about a collaborative divorce model is that it's interdisciplinary.
Mm.
So that therapists are often involved as coaches to deal with those emotional issues. And emotions are actually dealt with in the process.
Hmm.
So one of the most powerful programs that I ever went through was with, meetings. We had a many, many four-way meetings in collaborative law where everybody comes together. And one of the most powerful resolutions that ever happened was my client actually apologized for having an affair.
Oh, wow.
And she apologized so completely. And she'd been working on it with her divorce coach. And up until that point in the process, the other attorney and I kind of thought that things were just going to end badly. And when she delivered that powerful apology, everything shifted.
Wow.
And we resolved it. And so, and they never had to go to court.
And the marriage wasn't saved. They went through the divorce, did they?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Although when I was a mediator for a while, I had the reputation of being a very, very bad divorce lawyer because my people kept reconciling.
I bet you were pleased about that. Eh?
Yeah, I was.
And how are the legal costs in these situations?
Well, they're really case dependent. It's hard to compare a collaborative divorce to a litigated divorce when you're comparing apples to oranges. But in most cases, a collaborative divorce is much less expensive.
Yeah, I'm thinking it must be. Eh?
All of that stuff that's called discovery, which is about collecting information mm-hmm. that goes on for months and months and months in a litigation, is handled in a couple of meetings
mm-hmm.
in the collaborative process.
Hmm.
And so most of the work is spent with the people actually working on the issues, not just collecting information.
Well, so how much of the legal, how much of the divorce legal segment is actually working in a collaborative way these days? Or how many people have divorce coaches?
It varies by location. There's some locations where it's very common.
Hmm.
In Texas, when collaborative law was just starting,
mm-hmm.
they actually got a grant. Excuse me. They actually got a grant to promote collaborative law in the media and explain what it is to people. And so most of the firms in Dallas ended up getting training in collaborative law
hmm.
because their clients were asking for it. And so, a billionaire would come in and ask a law firm that they've been dealing with for a long time if they could get a collaborative divorce, and the lawyer would say, well, we don't do that here. We only do litigation. And they would say, well, we're sorry. We've heard of this collaborative divorce, and it's private, and it is faster, and it's cheaper, and it's more flexible, and we're going to go find somebody who will give it to us.
Hmm.
And so pretty soon, I think I may get the exact numbers wrong, but of the 16 top law firms in Dallas that do family law, 14 of them are collaborative law firms or
wonderful.
Offer collaborative law as mm. one of their options. So that's a place where there are a lot of people. Whereas, in some places, it hasn't really broken in yet. It takes at least two collaborative lawyers to work together because you have to have training to be able to do that kind of process.
But it's not that old a system. Is it like 10 or 15 years old or what?
The very first collaborative cases were done in the early 90s in Minneapolis.
Hmm. But is it moving like wildfire? Like when we're talking, I get so excited thinking that lawyers are being retrained to be holistic. How big a movement is this? You know, where is it the biggest? And are you hitting Washington, D.C. yet?
If you're looking at it as a movement, so I talked a little bit about restorative justice. I talked a little bit about collaborative law. Mm-hmm. There are people who are doing those that are doing them holistically, and their behavior is holistic, and their way of being is holistic.
So what does that look like?
So that looks like their hearts are in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are those who just saw it as a marketing opportunity and got trained.
Hmm.
And so they may be going through the motions, but they're not, I wouldn't call them holistic. And so it's hard to be able to count when it's really about when there's been a paradigm shift or not.
Well but, it probably would show up in, say, Harvard Law School, wouldn't it?
Well, there have been programs in Harvard Law School.
Okay.
Legal education is another one of those challenging places because legal education probably changes slower than the legal profession, and the legal profession is not very fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I can give you some evidence that this is spreading. So the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, maybe 10 years old, has over 4,000 members.
Wow. And that's an optional thing, of course, eh?
And it's optional.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem-solving court model, which we didn't talk about, but it's a holistic interdisciplinary model of focusing on getting to what's at the root of criminal behavior, so drug issues, homelessness, mental illness, domestic violence problems. That actually, instead of just putting somebody in jail, the problem-solving courts go for, we're going to get this person clean and sober. We're going to get them established in a home or whatever it is. And so it's a social work model that works with the court and is very, very effective, and there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 of those courts now in the United States.
Are they spread all throughout the states?
They are. Mm-hmm. Those are spread pretty much all around. Now, there's some communities that have a mental health court and a drug court and a veterans treatment court and, you know, so forth, but some communities only have one. Some of them focus on juvenile issues, and so 3,000 is a lot, and it's not universal yet.
Mm-hmm. It's not enough yet, probably.
Well, I would, you know, that's a value judgment that I would agree with, mm-hmm. that they're not enough. Now, I just wrote a book, Lawyers as Peacemakers, Practicing Holistic Problem-Solving Law, and it's an ABA bestseller. The American Bar Association published it in April, and it's been a bestseller ever since,
mm-hmm.
which to me is part of the evidence that this is something that people are really interested in and that it's spreading. But I wouldn't say that we've reached the tipping point yet, but I think we may be getting close.
Mm-hmm. Well, I gather what you're bringing into it as well is, you know, I was reading a whole bunch of commentaries about the book, and that apparently you're bringing in even some New Agey kinds of things and so on. There were some interesting comments about that. But I smile because, like, you're bringing in aspects of everything in our society right now, eh? Approaches?
Well, one of the things I said in the book is that all the things on Oprah, the bestsellers, are you know, holistic and spiritual, and lawyers read too. They're mm-hmm. part of that bestseller, but we haven't integrated it quite into the law yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there are lawyers who are astrologers who are concerned about, they don't want other people to know that they are doing astrology.
Yeah, and you referred to the Enneagram as well, huh?
And the Enneagram, you know, it's like that might somehow take away from their credibility as a lawyer. And at the same time, I've run into I've run into a number of lawyers who are mediums and psychic and energy healers and so forth that are out there, and they're able to speak to those kinds of issues in a way that people can hear them more than they might hear somebody else.
Isn't that wonderful?
They can bring their groundedness, mm-hmm. and their, you know, and their ability to gather evidence and talk about evidence in a way that makes a case and can bridge the gap. So it's kind of an interesting time.
No, it's very exciting. I just chuckled reading this because I gather some of the book is pretty pithy and has a lot of very intense legal material in it, right?
Well, it's a description of all of these different approaches, which, depending on how you count them, maybe anywhere from 12 to 20 different approaches, like restorative justice and collaborative law, each being approaches, and all the others that are like that. And then I also look at things like using ceremony and integrating meditation into a lawyer's life. And there's one piece in there that about a lawyer who prays with her clients. You know, it's kind of a really broad approach. Because the book is holistic.
I love that. So it's like people bring their spirit connection to whatever it is they're doing, which is very empowering, isn't it?
Right.
And their
right.
intellect, right?
Right, right. And the great thing about lawyers is that we have this great intellect, and when we marry it with, a passionate heart and, you know, grounded spirituality, it's really a great combination.
Isn't that wonderful? So you have something here called therapeutic jurisprudence. What is that?
Therapeutic jurisprudence is looking at the impact that the court system has and shaping it to be therapeutic rather than more damaging.
So it's a reorganization re-influencing what the court system is?
I would say yes, and part of what I described with the problem-solving courts, that is a therapeutic jurisprudence approach.
Oh, I see. Okay.
If people are going to come to court, do we want them to be more damaged when they leave, or do we want to actually be an instrument of healing? So a lot of the judges in these problem-solving courts are accused of being social workers, and they actually, instead of denying it, they say that society is sending social problems to court, and that judges are being required to become social workers. And so they're going to use what they call evidence-based treatments to actually interrupt the cycles that have people keep coming back to court.
Wow, that's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, this is sort of shocking to me because I had no awareness of this at all.
That's why I'm talking to you.
And that's why I'm really glad. So it's like, it is like, okay, so what about recidivism? How many, it's been too recent probably for you to find out if people go back in and out of the court system, or do they get transformed, or can they stay out, or can homeless people stay in homes, or,
Actually, the problem-solving courts are incredible. Incredibly successful in reducing recidivism. And I've seen news reports that in both Minnesota and Colorado, they overestimated the amount of prison space they needed and were struggling with what do we do with all this empty prison space. And in both news articles, interviews with people in the system indicated that the problem-solving courts had had an impact because the recidivism was down and people were not being put in jail for drug offenses anymore. They were actually becoming tax-paying, productive citizens instead of being in the prison system.
So that was through collaborative and therapeutic approaches. What did they do about the drug addiction thing?
Right, right. That was the in Colorado, I think they were, if I'm remembering correctly, they had 8,000 fewer prisoners than they were expecting, and they said that a lot of that had to do with the crime rate had gone down because of the recidivism rate going down because of the treatment courts.
And I guess a lot of crimes do come from, for example, drugs. So my question was like, okay, so if the treatment courts are working on the drugs, what kind of therapy do they use on drugs? Maybe we all need to know that.
They actually have studied what's most effective, and I'm not deeply enough involved to be able to say they use this model or that model. But the drug courts started in Miami, and they have been studying the effective treatments for as long as they've been in existence, and they just celebrated 20 years since the first drug court.
Wow.
And so they actually study what it is that works that has people get off drugs, and they do things like random testing, and they encourage people to stay clean. They provide them with a lot of support, a lot of recognition when they do stay off. I've seen courts where they applaud and give rewards for staying clean and sober, and they have graduations.
Well, that's kind of exciting, isn't it? It was really heartening for me. I just hadn't heard anything about this. This is wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Is it, we all get deluged with the numbers that are on the increase and doodly-doo, and drug being a really high one right now. Wow, this is really exciting. So what's going to happen, do you think? And is there any in the high legal systems of our government? Or do we know yet?
Eric Holder was actually known for his work in community lawyering.
Mm-hmm.
The Attorney General, and he's mentioned in my book from his early work, not his current work, and community lawyering, which is so that's pretty high. I would say that having a president who won the Nobel Prize for diplomacy is an example of this kind of approach. It's problem solving. It's resolution oriented, and he's of course a lawyer, and he's been a community lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty high. One of the Supreme Court justices in Australia just retired so that she could focus on problem solving courts. I just read that in the newspaper today.
Oh, that's very exciting.
So it's worldwide, mm-hmm. and it's in pockets in different places. So in one place it may be a focus on the problem solving court. And in another place, a focus on collaborative law. In another place, a focus on community lawyering. In another place, something else. And so most of the people who are involved do not even characterize themselves as holistic lawyers. Mm-hmm. They just have had a shift that is holistic.
Well, tell me this. With your Cutting Edge Law website, which is your virtual office, and even your book, are you getting more and more people like committing to it and signing up and passing it on and all of that?
Well, we're pretty new. We've only been on the web for about a year,
a
little more than a year, and we are getting more people signing up, and the site has gradually increased in traffic regularly. It's gotten attention in the media, and then of course the book being a bestseller has people become more interested and come and find out more at the website, because the book is a huge resource. I think that just the resources section of the 528-page book is I think it's a 75-page resource center in terms of just lists of places for more information. But then among those are some of the videos. My business partner and I have been on the road for a little over 2 years interviewing lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And we have over 100 interviews and something like 350 video clips of some of the pioneers and trailblazers in the movement.
Where do we get to see those?
If you go to cuttingedgelaw.com and go to videos,
okay,
then you can hear the stories of some of the people who have really been paradigm shifters. Hmm. You know, they came into a legal system that had the structure of this is how it should be, and they said, why? Why can't it be this other way? And they were successful in making the changes. And so those are the people we've interviewed.
So tell people what turned you. Why did you start all this? And how did you turn from being a divorce lawyer to a holistic lawyer? How's that?
Well, I was a holistic divorce lawyer.
All right. Okay.
and at first, when I started practicing law, I'll back up. I was not going to be a lawyer for anybody else. I was just doing it for my own family. And I had a terrible experience in law school with the adversarial nature of law school and sort of the cutthroat competition and the attacks on me. One person said that he was turning me over to the IRS because I obviously had way too much time on my hands.
Oh, my gosh.
I had 7 children and had started 3 organizations as a law student and graduated in 2.5 years.
Oh, my.
Instead of 3. And he was upset with me having too much time on my hands.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I was never going to be a lawyer. I graduated, passed 2 bar exams, and just kind of put all that on hold and ran a domestic violence program for a while and was doing nonprofit work. When I was in a course that was provided by Landmark Education called Wisdom, and I went to Atlanta for the course. And this guy from Chicago was visiting the course. His name was Forrest Baird, and he stood up in the course to introduce himself because he was a visitor. And he said that he practiced law in a different way, that he granted dignity to everybody, and that his divorce clients were still friends at the end of the case.
Wow.
And he was focused on the kids. And it was one of those epiphanies of, you mean I could do that?
Isn't that great?
I was just really...
And was he older, like a lot older?
Not a lot older, maybe 10 years older.
My question comes from this, is that it kind of is an indicator that there are people that have been practicing that way for quite a while, huh?
There are people who've been practicing that way and didn't know that there were other people who wanted to practice that way.
Mm-hmm.
What I hear more than anything is that people think they're alone.
Mm-hmm.
So around the country, I ran into people who actually called themselves holistic lawyers, but they thought they'd invented the term and they were the only one.
Uh-huh. And did they tend to be doing the very stuff we're talking about, which is collaborative and healing through the court sort of thing?
They did their own version, mm-hmm. whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Seattle, I met a woman named Stephanie Quain, and she was actually doing ritual and ceremony and helping her clients work through the spiritual and emotional issues in divorce long before she ever heard of collaborative law.
Oh, wow. Good for her.
And so when she found the model of collaborative law, she was trained and became a collaborative lawyer, but she was already practicing holistically.
Wow. Oh, well, that's good. Hmm. So you're a focal point for people to kind of come together around a style, eh?
Well, sometimes I talk about being the hub of the movement, and a friend of mine who does leadership training actually says that I'm a good example of a type of leadership that he's been studying lately. It's a new way of talking about leadership as being the gravitational core.
Oh, I like that.
And so, yeah, I like that too. I like the image of sort of being part of a solar system, and I'm magnetized to attract all the people who are doing these cool things. And then when they come to me, then I say, oh, well, what you're doing sounds a lot like what this other person is doing. Maybe you ought to talk about this, and maybe you actually are developing a new model here, or maybe maybe you can just provide support for each other.
Mm.
So 10 years ago, I started having weekly telephone calls, and I haven't done them for a few years. I just started doing them again. But in those calls, several times we had employment lawyers show up, and they were looking at holistic ways to do employment law, and then they would have conversations and do what I would call cross-pollinating.
Oh, that's great.
With the ideas, and so one was in California, and one was in Tennessee, and one was somewhere else. I don't remember what.
Well, this is like teleconferencing. Is that what you were doing?
And so we were doing teleconferences, and, and so they would meet, and then they would continue to become friends and talk with each other. And so it was less organized back then when it really did seem like there were only a few of us. But the longer I've been in this, the more I've realized that that it was much broader than anybody ever imagined. I used to think I knew everybody who was doing this kind of holistic approach.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are literally thousands of them that I've never even met that probably have never heard of me.
So what are you going to do? Okay, so you heard this fellow say that he's from Chicago. Eh? His name is Bayard, is that right? And you heard
Forrest
him. Baird. And you heard him say Forrest Bayard. Sorry, you heard him say that his divorced people always came out in harmony. Is that right?
Yeah, they came out being friends.
And so then you then took action, did you?
I went and took the North Carolina bar, which was not one of the bars I had already passed, and became a lawyer in North Carolina just a few months later. And I hung myself out and started practicing law, and I ran into the same thing that most lawyers run into, which this huge structure of the legal system that is not designed to be flexible.
Hmm.
And so I ended up practicing in what looked like a more traditional kind of way, in that I was doing litigation at first. And I thought, well, I'll be holistic with my clients. And then the other client was on his own. You know, I was at least going to be holistic with my client.
Hmm.
And what I discovered was that my clients were winning. I'm actually, I'm not one of those people who can't litigate. I'm really good at it.
Oh, good.
And so they would win, but then they would be miserable. So I kind of went through a few trials like that, where my client won. And in one case, this woman who was just one of the best mothers I had ever met, came to me and she said that if I ever have to go to trial again, I'm going to give up custody of my child.
Oh, wow. Because the trial was so excruciating?
It was, and the relationship between the father of the child and her was so damaged that she saw the ramifications for her child.
Wow.
And so,
do you remember Kramer versus Kramer, that old movie?
Yes.
That was, I still think that's momentous as far as understanding some of that.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the design of that system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have enough experience or options at that point to make other choices, but I immediately started exploring how I could. And that's when I found collaborative law and I found mediation, and I started experimenting with those in my own practice.
Hmm.
And at that time, they were pretty new. We had our first mediator in our community, my second or third year of law practice.
Hmm.
And so I learned how to do those things, and my office became an interdisciplinary office, and I had a social worker in the office and a counselor, and we offered groups for women and for men, and we offered one of the people that worked with me had been a guidance counselor, and she went into the school system and did groups for the kids whose parents were going through divorce.
Hmm.
as a volunteer.
Hmm.
And so we just started looking at how we were going to take care of people. And
so you were kind of experimenting, exploring, and testing it out, eh?
Exactly, exactly. And then after I had done that for a few years, in 1999, I was married to a man who got a job offer across the country, and he was a computer software engineer. And it's so long ago, most people don't even remember that in 1999 we were clear that the whole Y2K thing, there was going to be this huge crash. And so when he got an offer with a company that was going to be fixing that crash, we decided that he should take it and that we would move cross country. And so I left my law practice. And so I had gotten it to the point that I actually had a lot of models that were working, and I was happy with how it was. So of course that was the time that it was time for me to move to the next level.
Yeah.
And so in 2000, after I had moved to Oregon from North Carolina, I wrote a website which brought in all of these ideas that were pretty much new at that point.
Was that Renaissance Law?
And that was Renaissance Lawyer.
Oh.
And so I wrote a 400-page website, and I put it on the web. And
you have a very agile brain, my dear.
I didn't think anybody was actually going to look at it, to tell you the truth, because I was like painfully shy, but it was more like an organizational system for myself to store ideas. And then it actually became very, very noticed. And a lot of people, were interested in, they started calling me up. And, ever since then, I have been the go-to person for people who, discover these approaches and want to know how to do it. And so, for years, I was busy from morning till night just talking to people who discovered that these options existed, and that's how Cutting Edge Law evolved, because after a while it just got to be way too many people that I could talk to one-on-one. So I had to have a place where they could talk to each other.
So we go to Cutting Edge Law, and what do we get there besides wonderful articles and interviews and the videos, right?
But articles and videos and it's a membership community where people can comment and interact. We have phone calls for different purposes, several phone calls a month to look at things like we have one of our premium members is a young lawyer who has two small children, and she's focused on well-being. And so she's holding a monthly call for women lawyers to look at issues of having it all.
Oh, wow.
And then we have a monthly mastermind that I lead. It's whatever seems to be the conversation that I keep bumping up against.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in August, the conversation was opportunities for peacemaking in everyday life.
Wow, that's
great. And I had the members on the call actually coach me on an issue that I had, which was that my bank, let's see, I'm going to find a better way to say, I have been trying to close a bank account since the end of May.
Oh,
and
I went through that last year.
And I've been having a lot of opportunities to find more productive ways of communicating.
And how's it, and so are the people, are you able to get with that on your website and people actually communicate with you and help you through that?
Well, that was what the call was about.
Great.
People called and we looked at, we're not saints that somehow don't have conflict in our lives.
Right.
You know, we have our own conflicts and, in my case, I have a lot of people who look to me as the peacemaker. And it's probably not very attractive as a peacemaker to be thinking about the things that I would like to do to this bank manager who won't call me back or who hasn't called me back.
It's how you get through the white water that you're going to teach us all, right?
and so that's what we've talked about. And, you know, what are the things that the other people were having challenges with, and how do we approach those, and what do we learn from those that we can take back to our clients? And so that was the conversation this time. So whatever's going on, it's a, you know, more of a living conversation on our mastermind group of, you know, the members that come in. And then we have,
so people can put in their questions. So people can put in their own, dilemmas, can't they? And have that work.
Oh, sure.
And what about, do you have a lobby group at all or anything like that?
We don't officially. I'm kind of the I'm like a public relations firm for this movement.
Oh, I see.
I'm a missionary. I'll talk to anybody that will listen.
Great.
And so I've worked with a lot of the media. I've been working on several documentaries. I call up authors that, for example, recently I talked to an author who had just written a book on collaboration, and his expertise is on collaboration in all the professions, and he didn't mention law.
Oh.
And so I called him up and I said, hey, you know, I didn't notice you didn't mention law. And he said, I think law is what happens when collaboration fails.
Oh, my.
And so we had this amazing conversation in which I educated him about it, and then he wrote about it in his blog. And ordered the book to review the book. And so, yeah, I spend a good part of each day having those kinds of conversations and educating people about this movement.
Oh, it's very exciting. Do you get paid for that?
No.
So that people...
I depend on the memberships and sponsorships on the website.
Oh. People are really appreciating it, though, aren't they?
They do. They do. Mm-hmm. Really, the thing I hear most often is that people thought they were alone, and having a community is really important.
Well, and also you're known as we have to end this soon. I wish we didn't. I'd just love to sit and chat with you and hear all your wisdom here, or at least some of it. You've got more than I have time for, probably. But people can get you on Cutting Edge Law, but you're also a coach for people, right?
I coach lawyers, mm-hmm, on integrating their lives and their work, and finding ways to practice that are in integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I also coach people on their conflicts and helping them to see a different perspective on any conflict that they're in, and take responsibility for resolving it themselves.
Hmm. There's a number of different approaches these days on conflict communication, and I can't remember the terms, but I know there's different organizations that are teaching people to communicate better without conflict, right?
So yeah, there are a lot of those organizations.
It's really, to me, it's a rising tide in consciousness, I think. Hey?
I think so. I talk about honoring every conflict as an opportunity for transformation.
Well, that's great. So how do you see it all going? How do you see it all going in our country? How do you see it all going around the world? What do you think is happening?
Well, I think there's this wave that is bringing in a lot of new ideas and, you know, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to call it consciousness or, you know, expansion,
change,
you know, transition, transformation, and
or it's a smaller world. Maybe we're going to learn how to all live on it.
That I'd like to say that's what's happening.
Yeah,
I think what I actually see is that it's almost like we're bifurcating, and we need to know how to talk to everybody and not just the people who are like us.
I think that's really true. So, and one more thing is you have, we got to mention the name of your book again. What's the name of the book?
Lawyers as Peacemakers, Practicing Holistic Problem-Solving Law.
great. And it's pricey, but it's a very rich book, isn't it?
It is. It's the American Bar Association is a very small publisher, and so their books are pretty pricey.
But they're really reference material, too, aren't they?
It's a reference material, and it also was named one of their flagship books, which is one of their flagship books are those that they recommend to all of their members, and they think that they have some crossover value for people who are not lawyers. So
okay,
I'm really
okay,
proud
great.
To be among those lawyers.
Wow,
among the
we honor that, and also you and is it Michael Matthew?
Matthews is my business partner.
Yes, and aren't you putting out a video or a DVD or a movie?
We've been, we actually started the journey thinking we were making a documentary. And as we did the interviews, we decided to put them all up on the website and pretty much in their totality,
mm-hmm.
because each one of them was so wonderful. And so we call the website a documentary website.
Oh, that's brilliant, actually.
And then
another
also,
trend, girl. You're setting another trend.
And we're also working with several documentary makers, and we hope at some point to put together all of this into one project.
Well, I think it's very exciting. So that's what your next project is. Oh, and one more thing you said you wanted to talk about, which was non-location, what is it, non-dependent?
Location independent. So Michael and I actually gave up our homes, and I gave up my office in spring of 2008. And have been on the road ever since, without having put down roots anywhere. We stayed a few places for a few months at a time, but mostly staying with people. And we actually even spent quite a bit of time camping in nature. And we are responsive to wherever we're supposed to be. So we consider ourselves missionaries and really. Have a calling, and we go where we're summoned.
I think that's very exciting, and you're on a 17-day tour starting tomorrow, right?
I leave tomorrow for 17 days. I'm going to be in something like a 12 to 15 cities. I've lost count, and I'm going to be doing meetings, presentations, lunches, breakfast, dinners, about 30 or 35 different events. And landing in Salt Lake City on the 21st of September.
Wow. Well, I hope you have the most wonderful, and I know you're going to have a wonderful time, but I think you're going to have a huge impact on people as you go.
I think so. I think if nothing else, just the invitation and having them start to think about that this exists mm-hmm. is going to start affecting their consciousness.
Oh, I think it's very exciting. I can tell you, and we don't have any time, but the number of times I heard over the last week, you really can't trust the legal people. I'm going, this is going to offset a whole bunch of that. Believe me, keep your word going, and we'll tell everybody to look into cuttingedgelaw.com and write to you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for our time together, Kim. I'm just really honored, and I'm just really thrilled about what you're doing. So this is J. Kim Wright of CuttingEdgeLaw.com. Wonderful paradigm shifter, girl.
All right. Thanks, Veronica. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying, now that was a lot of food for thought, greater food for thought, more inspiring than I've had for quite a while. I love to think that our systems are changing and that we're all kind of incorporating a little more consciousness and care for one another. Take a deep breath, take blessings in from the universe, and breathe them out to yourselves and our paradigm-shifting community, and we'll talk to you soon. Good night.